the National Archives podcast series, an introduction to intelligence files from the Cabinet Office and the Foreign Office, released at the National Archives on the 23rd of May, recorded by Jill Bennett, Lord Wilson of Dinton, and Professor Keith Jeffrey.
I've been involved with both the sets of papers that are being transferred into the public domain this week. In fact, I'm probably the only person who's seen all of them, and that's not necessarily a thing I want to be reminded of. But they are two enormously interesting sets of papers, and I'm just going to say a bit about what they are and a bit about their context. I'm not going to go into the details on the Cabinet Secretary's papers, which Lord Wilson's going to talk about, but I am going to talk about the two archives generally. Basically, what these papers are the sort of papers that end up put aside in the too difficult, sometimes too sensitive, not sure what to do with it category. They're the sort of papers that get put into cupboards and boxes and rooms without ceremony by people who are very busy and who want to not destroy them, but want to keep them out of sight. And this is how I came into it, really. I retired from the FCO in 2005 as chief historian. And since then, I've been doing a number of jobs around Whitehall. And one of these has been to look at all the papers that people don't know what to do with, not quite sure, but they want to get rid of them, not destroy them, but they don't know how to dispose of them, whether they could be released, whether they could be given back to wherever they came from, or whether they still need to be retained. And so for both the Foreign Office Permanent Under Secretary's Department records and for the Cabinet Secretary's miscellaneous papers, that is what I've been doing now for the past few years. Both sets of papers are what is called outside their departmental file plan. Basically, that means they're not in the normal transfer at 30-year point with the rest of the departmental records. They are covered by statute and are withheld quite properly, but of course departments can decide to release these papers, which is what's happening in this case. And because these two particular collections are very much the same in time and content, i.e. they are all pretty well all intelligence related, it was decided by the Cabinet Office and the FCO to do, for this particular occasion, a twin track release, do them both at the same time. Certainly some of the material that is in these two collections will already be out there in other files. There's no doubt about that. It would have been impossible to take the time to check whether things were already out, and in some cases we knew they were already out. But what you get with both these collections is a unique way of putting things together. Cabinet secretaries, for example, collect papers together for particular reasons on particular subjects of sensitivity. And so they gather them in from all over Whitehall. In the case of the Foreign Office, there's also collections for rather different purposes. And it's this element which is so unique for the purposes of looking at intelligence. Of course, some of it will be out, some of it will not. Some of it certainly is not out. And some of these papers were random papers where the files had to actually be constituted. They were just literally piles of paper. So you have to look at them all line by line. And we have made up files, literally constituted files, so that you could use this material in a more relevant way. So there is, for example, in the PUSD papers, a wonderful and I think unique collection of papers that we've called Future of the Secret Services, which is in seven quite fat files. There is in the Cabinet Secretary's paper something unique, a complete set of the Second World War Secret Intelligence Service accounts on big account paper, handwritten. SIS themselves do not have a complete set of this. And the reason is that these were the accounts prepared by SIS to send to the Treasury to get the money. And that's why that set has sat in the Cabinet Secretary's private papers all these years without anybody realising they were there. There are also papers which, for example, papers of the Special Operations Executive. Now, as many of you know, SOE papers are mostly out. They're mostly here. But a lot of SOE archives were destroyed for various reasons. There was a famous fire at the Baker Street headquarters, for example. And in the cabinet secretary's papers, and who knows quite why, there are a whole set of papers applying for authority for what they called sanctions, which were wartime operations. And so although they're not in themselves super sensitive, they may well be the only set that exists now. Now, on the actual nature of the two archives, I'm not going to say very much. You have got in the material you've been given some introduction material about what the POSD archive is. Lord Wilson's going to talk about the CAB archive. I will just say a couple of words on why it's all taken so long, because I am aware that it has all taken a very long time. You do have to go through it line by line and page by page. Sometimes it is like a detective story or even a sort of cryptographical puzzle. You have to try and put this stuff together. It takes a very long time. Even then, you have to get all the relevant authorities to clear them. Physically, many of these files are in extremely fragile state. They have to be repaired. They have to be rebound. So this is an explanation, I hope, rather than excuse, but it does mean that it's taken a very long time, and I accept that. Also, technically, I am retired. It may not feel like it, but I'm not doing this all day, every day. I'd like to say a little bit about the content and the context of both these archives, and divide it into wartime and post-war. As you know, the POSD papers go from the outbreak of the Second World War in September 1939 up until 1951. The Cabinet Secretary's papers have an anomaly at the start of 1936. That's really the rather cute file about Mrs. Simpson, which I hope you'll all have a look at, but it's nothing really to do with intelligence. But the bulk of them are, again, from the outbreak of war until 1951. Now, in wartime, intelligence operations are often planned in a considerable hurry. Money is needed quickly. There's also a need for extreme secrecy, especially if there's anything to do with signals intelligence and, ULTRA and Bletchley Park and so on. There is a need, always during the Second World War, to try and persuade neutral or wavering countries either not to go into the war on the side of our enemies or to join it on our side. There's quite a lot of information to do with that. Before December 1941, there are efforts to try and persuade the United States to come into the war on our side. There is a wonderful collection in FO 1093/167 called America First. Now, this is not something that's unknown, but it's a big bound collection of papers about the movement in the United States against coming into the war. And it had a lot of major figures in it, like the aviator Charles Lindbergh, for example, a lot of extremely isolationist propaganda. This collection, which is very visually striking, as well as being interesting politically, is something which, again, has sat there for a very long time and I'm sure is not replicated anywhere else. In both the PUSD and the CAB papers, the basic underlying factor is money, essentially. The Foreign Office at this point is responsible for the administration of the secret vote for all the agencies. So basically, when they want money, they ask the Foreign Office. And they put their request, can we have £25,000 to start a magazine in Cairo which may influence people in the Middle East. I mean, there are some extraordinary propositions and some extraordinary sums of money, particularly, I would say, in respect of the attempts to prevent General Franco from taking Spain into the war on the side of the Axis. Huge amounts of money. Those monies are sanctioned through them putting their requests into the Foreign Office, and the Foreign Office passed them on to the Treasury. Something parallel is going on in the Cabinet Office. And the reason that these papers are where they are is because in those days, the cabinet secretaries almost exclusively came from being permanent secretary to the Treasury. So Edward Bridges, for example, came from the Treasury and he brought with him boxes of documents in the too difficult, too sensitive, lock them up category because he didn't want to look at them. He didn't want to do anything with them. He just brought them with him. And there they have been resting in the bowels of the Cabinet Office all these years. And there are things like, as I mentioned, the SIS accounts, the very specific requests for information and money for specific operations. Some of this also goes through the Treasury, and in particular, where other government departments, apart from the intelligence agencies, want money to do something clandestine, they went through the Cabinet Office. And that was then passed on to Sir Herbert Britton at the Treasury, and he was the man who dealt with any of what you might call covert monies. He called it dealing with the dark side. And it's quite interesting because you can see from the correspondence that he didn't want to know. He didn't want to know the detail. If somebody said to him, we need £10,000, he'd say, well, he'd almost signed it with his eyes shut. And huge amounts of money. It's not surprising Britain was bankrupt at the end of the war, if you read some of these files. Once the tide of the Second World War seems to have turned in military terms, really, say from the beginning of 1943, it's noticeable that in Whitehall a lot of attention begins to be paid to post-hostilities planning, thinking about what's going to happen at the end of the war, in particular to do with the organisation of intelligence. And you'll be able to see a great deal of that in the papers here. Now, during the Second World War, of course, the imperatives are victory. You have a war cabinet that contains Labour as well as Conservative ministers, and to some extent, political differences have been set aside in the interests of the war effort and the determination to defeat the Axis powers. And after the American entry into the war, of course, there are very close connections between Britain and the United States, not just in fighting together, but in things like the atomic bomb project, and in intelligence, and in signals intelligence, and in the formation of the early American intelligence agencies. And there is material on all this in both sets of papers. Then, of course, also the Soviet Union, which becomes an ally after this point. You have to come to terms with that in intelligence context as well, which is quite difficult. There is also a strong intelligence relationship with governments in exile in London during the Second World War, Poles, Czechs, Norwegians and others, and some of that is also reflected in these papers. Post-war, it's all changed. There's now a Labour government under Clement Attlee, and of course Attlee and Bevin had both been in Churchill's war cabinet and are very experienced. Attlee in particular takes a very close interest in intelligence, and there are quite a lot of documents about that. But with the Labour government, there are now different political imperatives, in particular, of course, the domestic programme of legislation, the formation of what we would now call the welfare state, but actually across the board. At first, what you see with Attlee and Bevin and others is an extreme reluctance to engage in anything which you might call covert. The use of secret intelligence, although they want the intelligence they're getting, they are very reluctant initially to authorise any activities, for example, espionage in countries which might be seen as being remotely friendly, or indeed in any sort of special operations. And what these papers on both sides show is the gradual realisation that in a world that may not any longer be in global war, but is in a new kind of conflict, secret methods are actually going to be needed. They have a lot of difficulties in getting to this point, and there is detailed documentation in the PUSD records about the first big covert operation authorised by the Labour government, which is Operation Valuable in Albania. And there are also new papers about the first really big spy case of the Cold War, the defection of Igor Gudsenko in September 1945. And although a lot of information on that particular episode is already available, what the PUSD papers give you is a great deal more about the political implications of what went on. There is also information about what happens when countries become independent of Britain, as Britain is divesting herself of her empire, particularly, of course, India and the formation of India and Pakistan. What happens to intelligence? Is it now foreign, or is it certainly not any longer ours? Who's going to deal with it? There's a lot of wrangling between MI5 and MI6 at this period. Relations with the Soviet Union, of course, sour pretty quickly at the end of the war, and the files also have a lot of interesting detail on what you might call the lowering of the Iron Curtain. These are important files showing, for example, how Ernest Bevin comes to his conclusions about what are we going to do to counter Soviet propaganda and espionage. I'm sure you all know about the formation of Information Research Department in the Foreign Office in 1948. There are pre-IRD papers in the PUSD papers, beginning with SIS plans for what they would like to do as a counter to Soviet activities, the watering down of those plans, and Bevin's own thinking. There's a wonderful file called Covert Propaganda, which is in FO 1093-375, where you can see the beginnings of all this. There are also, of course, problems with other countries. Israel, once it's been formed, that causes all sorts of political difficulties and intelligence difficulties. And, of course, China, working up to before Mao's victory in 1949. And there's an interesting file on the sinking of HMS Amethyst, which I'm sure some of you will know about. But apart from difference in relations with, if you like, the Soviet, what's going to be the Soviet bloc, relations with the Americans after the war are also completely different. The US emerges from the war strong, rich and powerful, and Britain is weak, bankrupt and dependent on the United States in many ways. And there are huge implications for whole facets of British life, including intelligence and, of course, atomic matters in particular. Having been a close partner of the United States during the Second World War, after the war, Britain finds the Americans much less keen on sharing than they used to be, even though relations are still close, and there are some interesting papers on that. The UN, of course, new body at this point, actually has great hopes for it. The Americans, rather less. There are interesting papers on that. And above all, there is a feeling that peace may not last. And indeed, a Third World War may be just around the corner. Now, we, of course, know that that was not the case, but that's how it felt in 1949-50, as you will see if you look at files like CAB 301-16 on the readiness of the Secret Service for war, and parallel files on deception in the post-war period, one in CAB 301-15 and one in FO 1093-380. So this is just a bit of a taster for what you're going to find in these files. There aren't, I would say, any striking shock horror revelations. This is not what these archives are about. Nor any big, hitherto unknown secrets. That there are certainly unknown stories. And that one I particularly like is that the true story of how the Polish politician Mikołajczyk was exfiltrated from Poland in 1947. Lots of people have told this story, but the real story is told for the first time here. But there is, in both archives, a great deal of what you might call collateral, which sheds a great deal of new light on a lot of British history during this period. And now I'll pass over to Lord Wills. Thank you.
The job of Cabinet Secretary is one which covers the whole of range of government, and occupants of my former post find themselves from time to time dealing with really difficult, really sensitive issues which probably only they can deal with. When I took over the job of Cabinet Secretary, just before I took it up, I had a series of sessions with my predecessor, Robin Butler, who very helpfully briefed me on the job and the parts of the job which I might not have known about. And in the course of that, he said, by the way, there's a strong room downstairs which our predecessors have built up lots of papers. The office can show you. I've never had time to go and look at them. I kicked myself over that. But you may just, if you can find time, may want to look at them sometime. And that stuck in my mind. And after I'd been doing the job for 2 or 3 years, I realised that exactly the same thing was happening to me as it happened to Robin Butler. Namely, that the immediate pressures of the job were pushing out any time I might have had to go and look at this strong room. So after a while, I made an appointment with myself in my diary to go and see what earth was down there. There's a kind of, not quite spiral, but there's a staircase, the sort of staircase which must have been made for servants, inconvenient and tight corners, which just at the back of the cabinet secretary's suite. And down there, there are some rooms. And I went down with my staff, and there was this door, which was well secure. And I went in, and there were two rooms, not one, which were, in my memory, are dark and dank, but there must have been a window. I think a window must have been onto the garden of number 10. And it was absolutely full of, these rooms were full of shelving with papers on them. And there was a paper, which Jill remembers, which is absolutely piled high with documents. My eyes swiveled, and I went and I gave myself this hour to sit down and just take papers at random. There were boxes, there were files, where there were simply heaps of paper. So far as I could see, there was no system in any of it. I may be wrong, but it looked to me as though people had simply, over the years, dumped things which they didn't know what to do with on these shelves. And quite a lot of the papers seemed to me to be loose. But when you looked at them, they were full of the sort of thing that Jill was describing. Not huge earth-shaking shocks, but a wealth of information which successive cabinet secretaries had dealt with and said to their staff, you better find somewhere to put this, it's quite delicate. And these staff, not knowing where to put them, had just put them somewhere on the shelves. Things that are, to quote, repeat what Jill said, too difficult, too sensitive, lock them up. And generations of clerical staff, private secretaries, must have thought, this is difficult, this is in that class, I must put it in the strong room. A lot of it, the papers that I looked at, were the kind of papers which are now being disclosed today to do with the intelligence agencies. It's worth remembering, when you ask yourself why all these papers were there, worth remembering that the agencies were only given proper, recognised, formal existence in the legislation of 1989 for the Security Service and 1994 for the SIS. Until then, cabinet secretaries, who had some overarching responsibility for their finances, cabinet secretaries must have regarded these with huge care and concern about their security, because they had a shadowy existence, and putting the papers away in a strong room must have been one of the solutions to the problem of what you do with their papers. I would emphasise, you may ask, why has it been allowed to build up for such a long time? The answer is, I think, not a question of malice of any sort. It is simply that there's a period when something is really delicate, when you want it to be secure and you want to be confident that it's not going to escape. And then over time, other priorities, pressures of daily life in government, mean that nobody has the time to look at them. And there comes a point when it is too big a task to know what to do with them, to be able to deal with them, and you hand it on to your successor. It seemed to me, when I saw the papers, that we had to grasp that nettle. We couldn't just let this go on building up. I believe, although I do believe in government, there are some things, and if you think about it, Jill has illustrated them very well, which, when you at the time, feel very delicate and could do real harm to the national interest if they're disclosed. But their radioactivity does decay. And I believe that ultimately there is a responsibility on public servants to make sure that history at least knows, has the full picture. And part of the of what concerned me when I read the papers was that these papers had, a number of them had a half-life which had long since decayed. and which they should be seriously considered. The only question was how on earth we set about it. And I commissioned a review of the papers with a view to getting them into the National Archive and bringing them into the mainstream of government papers, which in due course could be released to the public. I commissioned a recently retired senior official to review the scope of the papers, to report on them, and to propose how we should set about it. And I'd like to pay a tribute to my successor, Gus O'Donnell, who had the brilliant idea of getting Jill to come and take on this task, which involves an enormous amount of minute scrutiny of what the papers are, putting them into order, and then getting the full sanction for them to be released. I hope that this programme will still continue. I think it's hugely important because we've only got to, I think, 1951, and there's a lot more that lies ahead to be done. But I do believe this is an absolutely crucial exercise, part of the debt which all government owes to future generations to know the full picture of what lay behind events at the time. And I warmly welcome what is being done today.
I'm here partly as a user of these documents, as you are, I hope, and will be. But I cannot say how happy I am. I cannot tell you how pleased I am to be here at this particular event, this particular release of these wonderful documents. Well, that's kind of baloney, because I'm just about to tell you how happy I am about this. Firstly, I've got a kind of selfish pleasure at the availability of these. When I wrote or was commissioned to write the book, of course I had access, I had complete clearance, which I no longer have, to classified government departments, records. And among these was, of course, the closed archive of the Secret Intelligence Service. But particularly for, of course, the post-war period, I was able to use some of these POSD documents and the Cabinet Office documents in the book. And if you look at the references, I always tell my students to be very, very suspicious of any book that doesn't have proper scholarly apparatus, proper references, because we depend on the transparency of evidence-based history, and the proper historian, the ideal historian is able to, as the ideal journalist, no doubt, is able to provide the evidence of the basis of the materials, that the stories you tell. Now, I was unable to do that for the Secret Intelligence Service archives, but I was able to do it because the relaxation of conditions about releasing material related to the Security and Intelligence Services, which followed the commissioning of both the Security Service history, Christopher Andrews, MI5 history, and the MI6 history, meant that documents in archives other than MI6 collection, the prospect was that they were being reviewed for release. Now, this is back in 08, 09, so it's taken quite a long time for the reasons already argued, already discussed. But if you go through, it would be possible now for a new edition of the book, a little test for you, is to go through those anodyne references that PUSD archives are retained in the Cabinet Office. Is with those documents, you can now assemble proper, I've done it for some of them, but you can assemble this and get to the actual documents you use, which means that, from my point of view, people will be able to look at the actual materials I used and decide whether my history is actually worth it or not. You know, is it accurate? Am I using the things correctly? Because it's no use me saying, trust me, I've seen these and that's it. That's an inadequate, or professionally inadequate thing. So for a selfish point of view, this is a wonderful moment. I mean, apart from the enormous richness of these. Now, I advertised as being speaking about the importance of these papers to the history of the organisational development of British intelligence. And there's a kind of, you know, stupor will fall upon you, organisational development. This is not what's interesting, really, the army, it's the operational stuff. And one of the problems with the book when we were selling it to publishers, because of course they wanted the sexy, you know, sort of James Bond material. And I said, well, actually, this is an official history. It has to talk about finance, it has to talk about organisation, it has to talk about training, it has to talk about structure. And a number of publishers would say, well, no, we don't really want this at all. What use is this? What use is Chapter 18, post-war planning? And this is not what's going to get people on the station bookstall or the airport bookstall rushing to the book. But my argument is that in those organisational papers lies, you know, huge amount of interesting and valuable and revealing information about the service. So, I mean, there's a series of reviews and snapshots, but you give you pictures of the security and intelligence agencies at various moments through the period. There's a Hankey report. Hankey is sent in. He's a retired cabinet secretary. He's an old Whitehall hand who's brought in at the beginning of the war to look at both MI5 and MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, to review these. And there are these two reports. Now, the Hankey report has been out for some time on MI6 in other sources, but some of the papers relating to it are here, adding to the detail. The MI5 one, I think, is for the first time released here. Then there's a report on Special Operations Executive in June 1942, which gives you a kind of one-stop picture of what it's doing. There's the Bland report, it's after Sir Neville Bland, who is the ambassador to the Netherlands, government in exile, and he had been before the war. And another sort of old Whitehall hand looks into the future of SAS, and I'll come back to say a little word about the Bland report in a moment. Then there's Findlater Stewart in November 45 and MI5, and then the Brooke report in March 1951. So you've got these series of kind of reviews. Now, what do they show? Well, they show that there is a level of higher administrative and political oversight on the intelligence service. There's always this worry about the intelligence services being laws unto themselves. The commissioning of these reviews is part of the accountability process, about the governance process for these. Although you will find embedded in the documents related to this, and particularly Cavendish Bentinck, who's the secretary of the Joint Intelligence Committee during the war, he was a potential candidate to be the chief of the Secret Intelligence Service. There's extramarital difficulties ruled him out in those dark days when that sort of thing was thought to be important. Perhaps it still is. I couldn't possibly comment. And Cavendish Bentinck, of course, makes the point that clandestine organisations should be kept apart from politicians. They're just kind of a bit over-enthusiastic. Keep SOE, he said, away from ministers, because the kind of danger of them being too close. So there is a tension there between the practitioners and, of course, their political, let alone their Whitehall masters. So higher administrations there. You will also find there are sustained attempts, each of these embody attempts from various quarters to integrate the Security Intelligence Agency into one combined sort of huge centralised intelligence organisation. This is going to be much better. We don't want these different organisations doing it. They're always resisted. What comes out eventually in the British system is the overarching JIC, Joint Intelligence Machinery. The organisations remain. They do overlap in some areas. But also embedded in that are quite visceral rivalries between the organisations. I mean, they don't always get on well. They're competing for the similar sorts of resources. They're populated by the similar sorts of alpha male types. And there are these rivalries and tensions which come out between them. Then a third thing that they show are ministers and officials and practitioners grappling with the different types of covert functions. Human intelligence, which is SIS's core business, as it were. Signals intelligence, which is what was Bletchley Park, and there's a theme running through this, is how do you fit in signals intelligence to the whole network? It had been under MI6 during the war, even Brooke in 51 says it should still be the final responsibility should still be within SIS, although in the mid-50s that was going to change, and a discussion of how important signals intelligence is to human intelligence, and what sort of resources, and that's where the financial side is really important, what sort of resources are you going to invest in this? And then the secret intelligence and special operations. Jill said a little word or two about this, and the increasing enthusiasm with which not just the sort of soldiers, Montgomery was particularly fond of this in the late 1940s, but the government suddenly begins to think this is a low-cost way of advancing British interests, is using special forces to do stuff. And in most cases, that doesn't have actually very productive results in this, I have to say. But you find Brooke in 51, right at the end, is very, very keen on special operations of one sort or another, particularly behind the Iron Curtain.
And then by looking at each of these, and here is Bland, I think is quite important in this, the Bland Report 44, by looking generally at the subject of government-sponsored covert activities, they provide a uniquely revealing insight into the operations and the operational potential of those agencies, not just at the time, not just then, but also in a longer historical context. Peter Locksley, and you get these, you know, really important individuals that, who kind of lost to history. Peter Locksley is the private secretary to the permanent secretary of the Foreign Office, and it's the private secretary to the permanent secretary of the Foreign Office who's generally the bagman, as it were, the runner between the Foreign Office and the intelligence agencies. And at some stages, the MI6 is described and documented as Mr. Locksley's friends. So Locksley's, and Locksley's the man, the secretary of the Bland, he's the guy who writes the report. They're also, you know, you move down a level or two and you get these very important people. And he would have, I was going to describe, he was killed in an air crash on the way to Yalta, I think it was, conference. And I was, an early draft of the book, described him as a high flyer in the Foreign Office, but I had to cut that out for something bad taste. But Locksley talks, when they're talking about the Bland, about what SIS can do. He said, well, of course, after the war, the sorts of things it might do is to keep in touch with opposition groups in semi-dictator countries. There's a kind of resonance there that might be back-channel communications that might have a relevance that's not just, he was talking about the Metaxas regime in Greece, looking back, not just for 1944. Brooke, in another kind of comment embedded in these, which has a wider sort of resonance, Brooke talks about the dangers of over-administering SIS. He says the SIS officers would seem to be more engaged not in collecting intelligence, but in organising its collection. And there's, of course, the growth of these organisations runs the risk of sort of bureaucratic sclerosis, which again might have a contemporary or more, not just historical, resonance anyway. Anyway, there are fantastic riches in these documents, and it's easier for you to ask us questions about this. But two final points, just. One, it's a terribly good thing it's taken this long for these documents to be released. I quote one minute by Cavendish Bentinck in the essay. When they're discussing the future of SOE, the Special Operations Executive, which eventually is abolished or it's reabsorbed back into SIS, he has an interview with the commando hero Lord Lovett, who is, someone has suggested could be the head of SOE, could run it. And Lovett suggests to him that the Canadian, a man called William Stevenson, who had run British Security Coordination in New York, which was a combination, it was a kind of a model for the guys who wanted a centralised intelligence organisation. It was the one-stop shop for SIS and for Bletchley Park and for security and various other propaganda concerns in New York, that he could be brought over to run a unified organisation with all of Britain's clandestine services in it. Cavendish Bentinck makes a note that he'd warned Lovett off the proposal, pointing out that the great British public might be displeased if, after destroying Himmler, they suddenly found they'd allowed a similar person from Canada to come up in their midst. Now, what we know is if this document had been released in Sir William Stevenson's lifetime, there would have been a libel action straight away. He's a kind of sensitive guy about his... So it's a good job that the people, the principals involved in many of these, the individuals involved, are dead. I always recommend my students to study dead people rather than living people, because the threat of legal action is reduced for that. And I haven't even begun to celebrate the operational riches contained in these wonderful collections of papers. Jill has hinted at them, all the rest of it. There are bribes, there are secret weapons, there are assassination priorities, there's exfiltration of defenders, and there's Operation Embarrass, the literally and figuratively explosive operation to intercept illegal, or as the British regarded, illegal Jewish immigration into Palestine in 1946 and 1947. And it's all there for you, and I'll leave you to explore it.
This podcast was recorded at the National Archives Kew on the 21st of May 2013. This podcast is copyright the National Archives, all rights reserved.